papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis, a little bit of a step behind the scenes of what goes on in newsrooms, and we welcome you to join us with the conversation. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, with three colleagues in this room with me, the studio today. Here's Judy Patrick, vice president of the New York Press Association, who's a former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady.
Here and raring to go.
Raring, she is. Okay, Barbara Lombardo, the former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record in Troy, who is now teaching at UAlbany.
Hello there. I'm medium well.
Not rare. Oh, boy. She's here all day, folks. And Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio. Sir.
I'm a veggie burger.
I thought he was going to say, well done.
Well done. Yeah, no.
Oh, I wish I was that clever.
All right. We have a lot to talk about today. We should point out that we are, as we speak, actually, ahead of the presidential debates that are, of course, making news. But we're going to talk about the fact that it is the rules of the debate, the background to these debates, that are worth talking about in the context of the media. And I want to actually turn first to Ian, because in public radio, there is a unique situation here, because this is a commercial debate hosted by a commercial network.
Yeah, there are always complaints about the Presidential Debates Commission. It usually sets the rules for traditionally what were three debates. They were hosted by reporters from different networks on kind of a rotating basis and offered as close to a public good as we really get in this country. You know, if you were in October watching a presidential debate back in the normal times, it was on just about every network for a set amount of time with very limited commercial interruption. And the point was to try to get to some issues. This cycle, obviously, the big change is the commercial nature of the broadcast. CNN with the rights to the first one, ABC with the rights to the second one, and CNN set a number of rules for other outlets that might want to take it. Initially, it seemed as if it would not be available to public media stations to broadcast before NPR changed gears and finally worked out a deal at the last minute to be able to carry the debate. And it does show us, at least to me, that we're in a new era here for media for presidential debate coverage, because what was once treated as almost a public good is now being treated the way that so many of the presidential primaries were over the years, as really a cable news show. And maybe there's no getting that genie back in the bottle, but I think we're in a different place now.
Did the agreement come with any onerous restrictions on your ability to air this?
I'm not privy to the details of the agreement that were ultimately reached, but reading between the lines, this was a financial question in the first place. And also, NPR made the argument that, you know, it's going to be streaming online and it's going to be on YouTube, so there are other ways to see it. The fact is, for public media, as we've talked about on this show so many times, in a lot of places, the local NPR station is the only outlet for people. If you don't have a good internet connection, if cable doesn't go to your house, if you don't afford cable, then you're out of luck to see the debate, and maybe you're only seeing a filtered view with clips or whatever. And that's really what the conversation we have here at WAMC is always about. Like when we take the Supreme Court hearings from gavel to gavel, when a justice is going before the Senate to possibly be confirmed. If we don't offer that, who else is going to in a lot of cases? And with a presidential debate, it seems like a no-brainer for us to carry that live for listeners when it looked like we weren't going to be able to. Instead, we would send people to WAMC.org to watch an embedded YouTube stream. That's not convenient for everybody in the way that it might be second nature for younger users of our website.
Yeah, I would applaud WAMC for trying to think about how do we do a workaround. We do that in newsrooms and broadcast stations. What's the best workaround to serve your readers, and serving the listeners and viewers is your main goal there. And so that's commendable that you came up with that.
I will say that CNN established a number of rules for other networks to carry it, and it has to be branded as the CNN presidential debate. So Fox News shows the debate with a branded CNN graphic on it. So we've kind of gone through to a different era in broadcast media, I think, with this debate in particular. And in future election cycles, who knows who will be in charge, but will the Presidential Debate Commission ever get back together? Will we have a sort of nonpartisan person like Jim Lehrer doing their best to question the candidates on issues, or is this going to be a TV show for the foreseeable future?
Well, let's make clear that this happened because the Trump campaign declared 4 years ago, and the RNC declared that they would not participate in the Commission on Presidential Debates activity. So that left the ground open for negotiation by the commercial networks, and that's what led to this setup. So if there is a public-spirited candidate going forward on each side of the divide, then maybe there can be somewhat of a nonpartisan debate in the future. Though the notion that anything in America could be nonpartisan seems
again
dubious.
Well, perhaps both candidates would make that a provision of the September debate, that they will step forth and be on ABC, as we understand it, as long as the transmission is also made available to public media for the public good. That seems like a reasonable request.
Unlikely, given, again, that NPR is considered suspect, as is every other reputable outlet, by the Trump campaign.
Right. Even CNN that's airing it has been already pre-labeled as suspect or unreliable or hateful.
So we'll see. But in any case, you know, supposedly 70% of the American people getting the presidential debate makes that quite a phenomenon. There is very little beyond the moon landing that can match that record. All right. We have a lot of topics to talk about, as we mentioned today. And I do want to give credit, by the way, to the foresight of Judy Patrick sitting here in the studio with us for drawing our attention months ago to questions that you had about the assessments of the local news infrastructure in the country and what we're now seeing. Tell us about what we have here.
So Manila University has a much discussed study that analyzes the viability of local newspapers specifically, and it tallies how many papers are out there, how many have closed. And my initial looking at the data, it was missing many of the newspapers that I knew of. And now it's come to light that this is a problem all over the country. The data has overlooked a lot of small local news outlets and is flawed. One of the issues I came across was the initial data would only give you raw numbers about how many outlets there were per county, but it wouldn't name the outlets. So you didn't know whether your paper was in there or not. After questioning, they now added the names of the actual papers that they are accounting for. And everyone's looking at their county data and saying, hey, what about this newspaper? What about this news outlet? So I think, to be clear, local news organizations are suffering. They're struggling. Many of them have gone out of business. But the characterization that a large swaths of the country are in a news desert, I think, is an exaggeration. One of the problems with casting us as a dying industry, it makes it difficult for us to attract journalists, young journalists. It can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's why it's important for us as journalists to take a hard look, not to just accept the numbers, and take a hard look for ourselves to see if we truly are in a news desert, how much of an issue is it? And now the challenge is for them to be fully transparent about how many mistakes they did make and whether or not fundamentally changes their conclusions.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think in defense of the people that were doing this project, it's extremely complex and detailed. You know, there's the macro and the micro ways to look at this. And there were so many small outlets all over the country that you would have to consider to do this. And mistakes are going to be made and things are going to get overlooked. That's the end of my defense. It was horrible that they made these mistakes and then took too long to acknowledge them and then to try to correct them. And besides individual outlets, states and bigger news organizations are trying to use this data to justify things like tax exemptions to help eliminate or ameliorate the problem of news deserts. So you're using faulty data and it hurts our credibility as media.
Notwithstanding, let's just be clear that there is, as you said, a major problem of areas that are underserved by the media. A bigger problem, I would say, is ghost newsrooms. That is, newspapers that exist primarily as nameplates, where there are no reporters around who used to work for real newspapers, and now they have just a nameplate on what's essentially paper or even websites filled with stuff from elsewhere. So that needs to be dealt with, ghost newsrooms. But the thing that's interesting is that we are now talking about this data published by Northwestern University. And one of the great advantages of the internet era is that data can be updated instantaneously. It is real-time research, which is what they've now committed to because somebody finally got through to the dean there, Tim Franklin, a former major newsroom editor, and they realized, you know, this is not good journalism. If you're putting out old data, it's like something from the 1970s when some of us were practicing journalism long ago. Nowadays, we can do stuff in real time, and this is one of the advantages of the internet age in the journalistic ecosystem. You can have data updated to be accurate. And so, anyway, Judy pointed this out on this program months ago, and now finally the rest of the country is catching up.
Yes, there were problems with it, even with how they questioned and determined what coverage entailed. And you mentioned the ghost newsrooms. You know, that's part of it. And there could be a news outlet that's located in one county that also covers news in the neighboring county, or maybe they don't. And it was very haphazard.
You know, in Massachusetts, for example, the Quincy Patriot Ledger no longer has its own newsroom. The Boston Herald doesn't have a newsroom anymore. Their staffs are just tiny by comparison to what they were. And again, those are not quite ghost newsrooms, but almost so.
You know, one of the conclusions of the report was that half of the counties in the United States of America, half, had little or no local news outlet. It's an astounding number that really made me take a second look. That's one of the reasons I took a deep dive into it. For example, one of the counties they considered with little or no news is Schenectady County, the county that I worked in for, you know, 30 or 40 years. It has a strong local newspaper, has a weekly newspaper, and the neighboring papers come, the local radio stations, and we've got three or four local television stations that cover it. That's not covered as well as it was 20 years ago when I was on the beat, but it's still covered.
Right. One of the responses to the diminution of local newsrooms is now being taken by the Associated Press, which, of course, is a major 178-year-old news organization, which is now creating a new 501c3, a nonprofit, that will allow, therefore, philanthropic investment in local news and information coverage, which is a real advantage when you consider that the AP has this huge network of reporters that yet has been diminishing over the years. For example, every news organization I know of relies upon the AP for coverage, right?
And WAMC is one of them, although I think it's fair to say we've gotten less and less and less as the prices have gone up and up and up. And I say that as a fan of the AP, someone who's done some work for the AP over the years. I want it to succeed, but let's be frank about it. I sit in a newsroom that is paying attention really to four state houses. Four states. And over the years that I've worked here, the AP has effectively stopped reporting on the state of Vermont. They have almost no state house news coverage in Connecticut or Massachusetts. And those used to be sort of daily beats for the AP. So I would love to know more details about what this is going to look like. The thing that gave me pause is that, is the AP now going to be competing for the same pie as the rest of the nonprofit news ecosystem to try to prop up what is really a diminishing product? It sounds like yes. It sounds like we're going to try to get, you know, rich people to donate in much the same way that places like WAMC have been trying to do. Now, if it can save and bolster what the AP offers, I'm all for it, because we really do need those people in those places where they once were. They're just not there anymore.
So the advantage is the AP has relationships with local newsrooms, such as Northeast Public Radio, and what it doesn't have necessarily is the reporting team that it used to have. So they have now instituted new content sharing agreements with a lot of the emerging nonprofit newsrooms like CalMatters in California and the Honolulu Civic Beat and the Texas Tribune, which is sort of the big nonprofit newsroom that everybody uses as a model. So those organizations that create that content now will see it expanded and available around the country. And in places where there is an AP reporter, but not another nonprofit entity, their reporters will be strengthened, supposedly, by the advent of philanthropic donations. We'll see.
It can't hurt. Where things are going right now, and I'm on meetings with stations across New York State once a week who are either canceling their AP membership or they're going to. So let's see what happens here. But I think the thing to remember is, in terms of brands, the AP has something priceless. I mean, if there is a breaking news story, if there is a decision from the Supreme Court that comes down, most of us find out first by an AP news alert. And that has been the case for, you know, over a century. And that is not something to be trifled with in the long run.
All right. We will be paying attention to that. If you're just joining us, you'd like to share your thoughts. Media@WAMC.org is how you get your emails to us, and we'd be happy to take that into consideration and even read your golden views on the air. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ian Pickus talking about Media of the Week. Here's a media story, folks, that has broad implications, and we'll call it a media story for the purposes of this show, and that is Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, whose plea deal with the United States resulted in him finally being released from prison, going home to Australia, notwithstanding the publication of classified military and diplomatic documents that got him in trouble so many years ago. And I think it's worth exploring what we think about this, because there are different ways of viewing Julian Assange, and they are relevant media questions. Is he a courageous whistleblower of government misdeeds, or is he oblivious to the harm that his leaks might cause and basically simply a self-promoter?
Or all of the above is kind of where I fall on that one. As a member of the media, we're excited to get information brought to us that will expose government wrongdoing and raise questionable practices that need to be brought to light, and otherwise we wouldn't be able to get our hands on. On the other hand, when things are released in just a haphazard way and not in a thoughtful way, that's dangerous to the people whose names are released, possibly, and to the whole concept of protecting our democracy.
Yeah, what a complicated case. I have such torn emotions about this. But the bottom line here is whether or not journalists should be prosecuted under the Espionage Act, and whether this whole scenario has set a bad precedent for us going forward, because the rule has long been the Justice Department does not prosecute journalists if you acquire information that you shouldn't have, but you didn't steal it, you didn't do anything to acquire it, someone gave it to you. If you publish that, then that's in the public interest and you have a right to do that. And that is the rule that's come into question here. And I don't know whether you will see similar prosecutions going forward.
But I would not consider Julian Assange a journalist.
There's the question, isn't it? So if he's not a journalist, what is he? And how do you define you're a journalist if you are, consider the case of Edward Snowden, who's a National Security Agency contractor. Once his material was released, could he not claim an exemption from prosecution as a journalist, the same way that Assange might have?
And he had different instincts than Assange. Assange's instincts were post anything, don't redact anything, and the chips will fall where they may. Whereas with the Snowden case, the first thing he did was get Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras on a plane to go through the documents and see what they had, and trusting journalists to say, well, this we need to run down, this would be dangerous to publish, this should go out. And they worked on it with newsrooms across the globe to make some good judgments, as opposed to the Assange posted online and worry about it later. There was a quote that we read this week from one of his former colleagues, James Ball, who said, "Many journalists, myself included, and many who are no fans of Assange, said the prosecution was a risk to press freedom." And that's the issue here, is the edge cases need the protection for the rest of us.
Now, if you're talking, though, about Snowden, he takes the fall. Mm-hmm. But journalists did the thoughtful work of redacting names and so on.
And Snowden is still in exile in Russia.
He's a citizen there now.
Mm-hmm. So Assange is guilty of, in effect, publishing it himself, of being an independent contractor and not going through. Are we setting ourselves up then as the credentialing agency for the protection of whistleblowers? That is a bit of a difficult role for journalists.
Journalistic prior restraint.
Oh, so you see how difficult this is.
It is. Well, there are journalists, maybe one who was going to be heading up the Washington Post, who can get in trouble for possibly using material that reporters obtain through thievery. And you might suggest that the same thing is happening with these leaks.
That is an interesting issue, because there's been a lot of talk about the differing ethical standards between British and American journalists, but it is a fine line. And it is whether you induce someone to commit a crime to get information, thereby paying them, for example. This is the case with Robert Wynette, who now has withdrawn from his appointment as Washington Post editor. Because in America, we don't do that, at least in our line of work, the old newspaper world. We don't induce people to commit crimes to get information. In England, they do. they break into places.
You know, and I think the average person doesn't have a good understanding about why in America we do what we do in terms of publishing secret information or classified information. Because as journalists sitting here, we know that there are things that are classified or secret that the government doesn't want us to know that the public really should know. And we've seen that time and time again. If the government had its way, it wouldn't let us see half of what we see, from the Pentagon Papers to Chelsea Manning. These are important documents that we have a right to see, and government is disinclined to release them. There are cases in which it's really imperative that they know.
We note that there is not an exemption to the Freedom of Information Law for embarrassment. That is, you're not allowed to withhold documents from citizens based upon the fact that it might make government look bad or individual politicians. Yet, there is a role, isn't there, for secrecy in international affairs to protect the public security of the nation. Yet, it's our job as journalists to try to pierce that veil and then to try to make reasoned judgments as to what kind of a role we want to take. Same goes for public safety on a local level. You know, I've been in possession of police information that would have endangered people, I think, to have had it released, and we've made judgments not to publish it. That's thoughtful journalism, but it's hard to explain that to people and not sound like you're trying to cover up potential wrongdoing or else that you're careless about your role as a journalist and think you ought to be able to publish anything.
It brings to mind the kind of famous 20-year-ago stare down between George W. Bush's White House and Bill Keller, then at the New York Times, over reporting on the warrantless wiretapping. I mean, we know the contours of what the arguments are going to be, even though the details and the people change. The government, especially with respect to national security, is always going to be on the side of not disclosing things. And it's the journalist's job to make a fair determination about whether the public should know these things. Now, can you imagine living in a world where the Times never published that story?
And yet, what do we say to people when they say to us, so you're the gatekeeper, who invested in that power in you?
Yeah.
I think it's a valid enough question, but I would say, well, I'm a citizen.
The founding fathers in the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. That's the answer to that question.
That's a great answer.
It's hard to beat that.
Yet we don't credential ourselves that way. And there are these contests often between public officials and journalists where they are saying, who are you to decide whether this information should be
out and there's
there?
A sense of arrogance that can be perceived among the media because we think that we're righteous and we think we're going to do the right thing because we have our hearts in the right place and we want to help our citizens know what they need to know, what they ought to know.
I think that's fair. So we try not to be self-righteous. There's a fine line in that language, but it's a good thing, we hope. Again, share your views, media@wamc.org, here at the Media Project. That was Barbara Lombardo here with Judy Patrick. I'm Rex Smith, and Ian Pickus is here. We did mention that Robert Winnett, deputy editor of the London Telegraph newspaper, is not, in fact, going to become the editor of the Washington Post, which job he had been offered by the publisher, another Brit named Will Lewis, hired by Jeff Bezos, the owner. And there has been quite a hullabaloo about this storied American journalistic institution. And now the question is, what kind of a future will emerge in the Washington Post newsroom? The question about ethics across the Atlantic is a valid one. But if you are a British journalist who has engaged in behavior that would not pass muster on this side of the ocean, I think there's a question as to whether you can actually inhabit the role of Washington Post editor.
I think there is no question.
But Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, obviously thought that this was a good mix or a good match for the storied Washington Post, that maybe the Washington Post needed the shakeup that these British lads would bring. Now he's backed off a little bit, but Will Lewis remains his publisher.
Well, I would say probably he hired Lewis only. Don't you think? I doubt that the hiring of an editor maybe went to the owner. Maybe it did. I don't know. Who knows what Jeff Bezos actually does from one day to the next?
He seems relatively looped in. It was really a fascinating thing to watch. I mean, this ended up being front page news reported by the Washington Post news staff that effectively mutinied over the hire. Talk about misreading your workforce. You know, but the Washington Post journalists did what they did best.
It is amazing. Now, I think that a lot of the good reporting was done by the New York Times, but subsequently, the Post did jump on it and reporting about their own newsroom. And to the credit of the Washington Post, a retired senior editor was brought in to oversee the newsroom's coverage of their own organization, right? This is a significant thing that there is someone, a genuine independent journalist, overseeing the coverage of your own organization. That, by the way, is one of the things that separates journalism from a lot of other businesses. We air our own dirty laundry, and that's how people know about some of the ethical questions in American journalism.
And that's why we're so righteous.
And if you're having an all-staff meeting with reporters, it is being recorded, even if you didn't plan on it.
Yeah, bear this
free PSA, folks.
Journalists do tend to report what they hear and see. All right, that runs us out of time, I'm afraid, for this edition of The Media Project. Ian Pickus there, and Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, and I am Rex Smith, with gratitude to our producer, Dave Yostina, and to you folks for joining us, and we hope you will come back again next week for The Media Project.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now news.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
But publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.